We'll begin this evening's meeting of the Finance and Facilities Committee, September 9th, 2013, 6:01 p.m. Would you please take a moment and review the minutes from the last, from the August 26th Finance meeting? Let me know if they meet with your approval.
They meet my approval.
Meet with your approval. Patrick?
Okay.
Okay, then the first order of business is the FGM contract renewal. This is something we start annually about this time of the year, and it will be walked through our typical three-step process. That is the Finance Committee, the Board for Discussion, and the Board for Action in September. So I'll just take a quick walk through these amendments as they're referred to here in the Board Report. Amendment 24, it is the additions and remodeling work at multiple sites. This is the work that the board had approved previously in terms of schematic design for the project that we're recommending, and that is totaling $170,718.01, and then there is $20,000 in potential allowance built into that contract for a total of $190,000 and change. Amendment 25 is a roof replacement work at various sites. Patrick, you just asked about the work that's proposed for next year. We have not done any substantial roofing work for a number of years here. We are approaching that time level where we're going to need to start addressing roofs each year. And this year I'm recommending that we're going to move forward with approximately $750,000 of work, roofing work. The final sites have not yet been selected. We're still reviewing that information and expect that to be back to the Finance Committee with a recommendation at that first or the second meeting in September. And that's rather typical. We'll start to bring in capital projects and so forth. So yeah. That's Amendment 25.
But I just, for Joe's clarification, the amendment for 1.1.2.5.1 and 0.2, I think those numbers have just been flip-flopped.
Okay. What page?
Lower.
Up and top.
Page 11.
Okay.
And so it's just a...
We're meeting again tomorrow morning with the architect, so this is something that I'll go over and make sure that we get settled away for our next meeting.
My question is, you want to keep going or you want to all at the end? Or?
Yeah, let me just keep going because I'll run through this pretty quickly. Good. Some of it is work that we do annually, so just as the architect of record, the architects are the architect of record. And so these are things that we just normally go through every year. And then every year we also have changes to the contract in terms of work that the board would like to see done, whether it's a capital project, you know, we're talking about lands for next year, whatever that work may be. So Amendment 26 is the mobile classroom inspections. That's typical. That's something that's typical every year. They have to be inspected. That's usually done during the late spring prior to summer. And that runs a cost. That is at a cost of $4,500. Project or Amendment 27 is a roofing evaluation. That's something that we have annually where the architects will come out and do a walk of our roofs, and actually they prepare a report for our review annually. And they also will sit with Dave and I, Dave Scarmato and I, and determine the scope of work, the number of projects that we'd like to accomplish in a particular summer. Amendment 28 is just general services, and that is anything outside of what's already been identified here. And they meet, the architects and I will meet with village officials, the county officials, whoever else needs to be part of a decision-making process as we move forward with a variety of recommendations. Basically, anytime we touch the exterior of our building, a parking lot, a roof, the exterior of a building, wall, whatever it may be, it requires that we have to meet with the village. There is typically a public hearing involved with that. So we have a public hearing. The village board will have a public hearing. And they generally attend those meetings with me to provide specific services, professional services. If a question of a technical nature needs to be answered, they're there to support me. Also attached here is the hourly rate schedule and client fee schedule. It's attached as Exhibit A. As I mentioned previously, we have $400,000 in professional services budgeted for this coming fiscal year, the budget that was approved back in August. And so, again, we'll be walking this through our typical three-step process, and we'll be looking for approval at the October 15th meeting. Joe, you had a couple of questions?
Yeah, I have a lot of general questions. So
I think I got
stop me at any time you want.
Pardon?
I mean, you can stop me whenever you want. I mean, I'll probably go into too much detail on some of this. But, you know, I look at this and in their, for the first, I'm going to go all over the place here, but in their additional and remodeling, they're naming surveyors and structural engineers and, you know, MEPs and civil engineers. Now, have we, did they go through an interviewing process for this project already and pick out Erickson Engineering as their civil engineer?
We have used, these are all district architect, or not architectural, but engineering firms. We've used DC Consulting for a number of projects. This building flooded a couple of years ago. They came in and did a, they came in and determined why it should flood.
Yeah, they did an assessment of the problem.
They assessed the problem. We use Erickson Engineering for all public works projects like stormwater and things of that nature.
So
we use AMSCO for all of the electrical and
so
support.
So we're predetermining our engineers and our, you know, surveyors and all that for the project prior by signing this contract, because they have the names in it, by signing this amendment?
You know, I have never had, if I were to say to these guys, and we've had questions about a couple of engineers previously, and if I had a problem with an engineer, it would be up to me to pull that particular engineer.
Mine's not from a problem of performance. It's more from when if I'm looking at an amendment and it's speaking specifically to a, call it a sub-consultant,
mm-hmm.
That's what it's acting as. They manage them, which I'm all for you, because if you had to manage all these consultants, it would be mind-boggling. And people do it, but it's not necessarily for you to do, in my opinion. However, are they going out and going to surveyors and saying, okay, we have to survey 4 schools, and I want to go get the best pricing for these specs?
That's exactly what they did.
Okay, even so they've already done that, and Webster's already given them their quote?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Webster's work is done. I just got, the surveys are already done. There was an email that came through at 5 o'clock this afternoon regarding soil borings and who our final selection is going to be on that, because I know we got pricing on two different firms.
So they provide that to you, make a recommendation, and you give them the yes.
And then I say yes or no.
Okay, that sounds good. I just want to walk through the process.
Yeah, that's clear.
Can I just make a point?
Sure.
In terms of once a year, we, by policy, we go through a rubric of our consulting services. That includes FTM, that includes
Erickson,
it includes a number of these vendors. And we go through this rubric. It is discussed in finance, and by policy, you know, it's kind of like we do a thumbs up, thumbs down on the different vendors.
And we just did
that. So, to your point, although we didn't necessarily say we didn't specifically say for this project, you know, we didn't necessarily predetermine. We had this through policy, through finance, that these vendors were.
They're acceptable for professional services.
Correct.
And I'm fine with that. The way I look at doing this work is that if I'm hiring the architect to manage this, which I've already stated is necessary in this case, I just want to make sure they're going out and getting 3 bids. I always say 3 bids. You need 3 bids. They got 2 on soils test.
On soils and surveys.
To me, I'd like to see 3. There's enough soils engineers out there. There's a lot of good ones. You get 3 of them, I'm fine that they got 2. I'm not objecting to it. I'm just saying, standard-wise, I'd like to see 3. The fact that I now know you get to review them.
Yep.
The specs are usually not exactly the same, even though you ask for the same specs. You know, it's just the way the world works. When they're doing bids, they're going to try to prove to you why they need to do it a little better or what have you. That's all I wanted to make sure is that was occurring at the one level down. The architect up here, their subconsultants.
Yeah.
It's happening. I'm glad to hear it, and that was the main reason I brought
these professional services. The contractors involved, they will send me the documents, and then either I approve or disapprove, and I sign the contracts. FGM does not sign those contracts.
Okay.
We hold the contract.
Okay, good. I like that better, too.
No, we hold the contract.
And sometimes they'll show up with you at a village meeting if it's stormwater. They're going to be there with you.
Yeah.
Not FGM. Well, FGM may be there, but...
When we did Hadley, when we did Franklin, I had the architects with me. I had... Erickson Engineering and so forth, and all these companies have a relationship with the district that has gone on quite a bit of time. It predates me. It predates Dave Scarmato. So we didn't bring any of these guys aboard.
There's clearly a value in that because they know the building.
They know the building. Matter of fact, one of the gentlemen from AMSCO Engineering was a former director of buildings and grounds here 15 years ago. So if you ever need any
history?
Advice or history of what went on in a particular building, he's a great resource.
He knows all the secrets.
That's important. But it's also important to competitively bid them so you're keeping people on.
Absolutely.
That's a big part of it. And speaking of that, I'm sorry,
kind of a corollary to what you're saying. Can you make sure going forward with the FGM that you get three competitive bids? I don't think that's a problem. I think to address Joe's concern, just going forward, if you're good with that,
you could request three bids. You may only get two, and I'm fine with that.
I mean, it's like best efforts.
Right.
And my bet is they probably requested several firms, and maybe these are the only two that submitted.
That's possible too. Right. And then that's something you may not know.
And I, typically, but I know I see at least two for every recommendation you bring to me.
That's great.
Best practices, when possible, we'll get three bids.
Now, do you know, does FGM have in-house engineers, too, or they outsource
them? I would bet they have some engineers just by knowing our operation.
Okay.
But I know that they utilize outside services for, like, the water detention, mm-hmm. and then because of our relationship with AMSCO and so forth, they typically rely upon those folks. I know that there are times when we've had an emergency situation where they need an engineer to come out and sort of sign off on something. It's an in-house guy who usually takes care of that.
It's good to have those guys, and I'm glad to hear they do.
Yeah.
It's important because you may need a quick answer. They can review the other engineer's information and get you feedback that you need for...
Well, that's what happened. When we installed that nano wall at the Hadley Library, there was a steel question that came up, and we needed an engineer on site right away. And they came over, they signed off on it, reviewed the situation, and signed off on it.
Excellent. Now, the last question I have on the FGM stuff is, they've been with the district a long time.
7 or 8 years?
Now, have we gone out and interviewed anybody else and said, hey, what do you guys think about the situation we have here with portables and all the remodeling possibilities or what have we?
No, we have not.
Okay.
No, we have not. They actually predated Ann Reebok. They came here, I believe, with Jack Barshinger a number of years ago. These are guys that this is a company that has, I guess, from my perspective, goes above and beyond the call. I give them a call on a Friday night, a Saturday morning, whatever the case may be. They're available to come out. They know our buildings well.
I just go back to, it's always good to keep people honest. People are honest. You love working with them. The working relationship, the history matters. But to me, I'm not saying replacing no one. Please, their history has a lot of value to the district, mm-hmm. and that's something that a learning curve that's hard to go up, and at this time in this juncture, probably one you don't want to go up. But to me, there's a lot of people out there that do this just like they do every day and will give you the same service,
sure.
and perhaps even better. You don't know. So it's always good to keep your eyes and your ears open and even interview people when it's just a possibility. Plus, you could have an issue one time along your project that you really have something that blows up in your face. And then you're like, we relied on these guys, they're key employees, gone, whatever, died in a plane crash, it happens.
Whatever, right.
It happens. So it's always good to be aware, what are my other options? And if you're pricing things out, it's good, once again, to look at somebody else and say, well, what's their bid? Was it 170 or was it 132?
FGM may be still the same one you go with, and you may pay them 170, or they may say, I'll do it for 132. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, it's something in my mind that is normal practices, is to always, you know, being aware of what other people are out there. Sometimes it's, you know, going to a lunch and meeting a new architectural
firm.
You know, it happens in business normally.
And, you know, we get firms, whether they're architects or engineers or attorneys, I mean, we have firms all the time contacting the district to see if we would be interested in your services.
I bet you do.
So that's just something that's
good business.
Bob, is there an opportunity here in these amendments that I know FGM is very, helps a lot with the district and all that, but it's funny you brought that up, because I was actually looking at, is there one like the roofing inspection or something like that, where we know it's just going to be coming in, taking a look, so you can kind of get a taste of somebody else to say.
I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a little story here. I had a board member a year and a half, 2 years ago, asked the same question. So I called two different resources that I have and asked what would it cost for a district with, you know, we have about 550,000 square feet under roof. And so I asked them, what's your ballpark figure for a roofing inspection? And they said between $15,000 and $25,000. So that's a significant value what we have now, because we bundle everything, we package it all together, and they know our buildings. They know what to look for year after year. But I did have a board member ask that question the last board.
Patrick, the typical practice, from my perspective, for these architects, they want the big contract, they want to do the drawings. They want to do the schematics, the stage, the First Amendment we're doing here. The corporate services, as we call it, where you're getting $170,000, $180,000 a year. All that other stuff, you're going to throw it in for dimes. You're going to get your lost leader, because you don't want somebody new coming in and bidding it and then opening that door and suddenly you like these people. And they, once they get on your roofs, they have more ideas for you.
Yeah.
How they're going to, you know, your downspouts are off. This is off. You know, we could save you on stormwater. The way you're doing stormwater just from your roofs is causing more problems at Lincoln than you should have. That's what happens. And they always want to be the guys that, you know, value engineer something the minute they get on the roof. So there's just competitiveness, right?
Yeah.
These guys don't want them on the roofs. how do you keep them off the roofs? That's one cheap price. Those prices to go through the roofs, the prices to go through the portables, they're giving that away.
Okay.
That's why you got to bid the big one.
Yeah.
You got to interview and bid the big one, because that's what everybody wants. Because ultimately this leads to the drawings for the additions, the drawings for the new.
And then another point, I got a couple architects friends, and institutional architects friends, and I threw the rates out there and I said,
I actually think the principal's pretty low. Well said.
Bob, let me ask you another question. I mean, I think we talked about this a year or two ago. Is there are certain things that if we went out and we did a bid for architectural services, we have is this a class of vendors that we always have to take the lowest bid?
No, as a matter of fact, it's not an RF, it's not a request for pricing or a bid. It's a request for proposal. And typically, what we're doing with the construction manager, they're going to submit their list of qualifications that makes them the appropriate choice for this type of project, and typically pricing is not part of the supposed to be part of the overall evaluation model. It's matter of fact, I've even seen it where they don't even submit their pricing for a particular service because it's supposed to be based on the most highly qualified,
right.
not bargain basement prices.
No, I know. I think it was a year or two ago with the accountants, we went out for bid.
And we didn't have to do that either.
Right.
But we chose to do that.
Right. And I think again, we have a great relationship with our auditors. I like these guys. They're top rate. But you know, like you said, Joe, it's nice to try and keep people honest. We had three bids. We had
about eight bids. Well, we interviewed three.
Interviewed three. And we actually picked the middle one.
That's correct. We did not pick the cheapest.
The cheapest because we didn't think that the cheapest was, had the heavy horses to get what we wanted done from an auditing standpoint done. But, you know, it's a process. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this rubric in place for architectural services. Architectural services are listed specifically per the school code, so we have to have an architect of record.
Yes.
If the finance committee thought we can't do it this year, but next year we wanted to go out for bid, you know, I would open up that to the committee in terms of discussion on that. I'm not opposed to that, but we can't do it now. If that was a goal of the committee, we could plan on doing it next year.
And my goal is to get a baseline of understanding where everything is and how it was handled and all that, and I feel comfortable with that. I mean, if that's something we can talk about at a later date, because I'm not suggesting it. I just wanted to get an understanding when I gave what I thought was a good idea.
Sure.
The thing on the roofing, I wrote this in the email, to me is, you know, you haven't determined exactly where we're going to do roofing. And these are roof repairs. These aren't replacements.
These will be replacements.
Okay. So if we're doing full roof replacements and we're doing additions and stuff, to me, I mean, if you're on Ben Franklin and we choose to do additions and that one needs a replacement, then they should be doing that at the same time.
Sure. Yeah. And what we did want to say, and Paul and I talked about it this afternoon, is we would never recommend a particular roof replacement if we had plans in a year or two of making some changes to that.
Right. And mine is not just the changes. Mine is is mobilization and all that.
Oh, yeah.
If you're working on one site, your pricing is going to be a lot better. If you have to mobilize and go to another site and just do a smaller job, you're not going to get as key pricing.
Sure.
If we know we're going to do these things over 4 years, then you just group them together so you get the efficiencies of really its mobilization in the construction business. So.
Absolutely.
And again, the roofs has been, Bob will tell you, that's been one of my pet peeves. You know, as long as I've been on the board, where are we at with the boards, with the roofs?
Well, we're there now.
We're there now.
Do something.
I think the issue is, and the point is that Bob and I were talking about, you know, over the years is, you know, what do we need to do to kind of set money aside from operations to kind of like have a savings set aside for
like a normal building reserve.
Right.
Well, we have about $15 to $20 million worth of roofs on our building, so it's a substantial commitment that I think we should dedicate X number of dollars to every year.
But you've been doing that. You've been setting aside money for projects.
Oh, for capital projects, we do $1 million to $1.5 million every year.
But you didn't specifically set aside.
No.
Because that's again driven by school code. If we were going to specifically set something aside, we can only use it for.
If you identify it for a particular capital project, you can't go back and change that. If I were to say, you know, this year I'm going to do $500,000 next year worth of roofs, and I'm going to save the money from this year, I can't go back and change that.
And say, so now we
have. Now I want to go on to another builder. Yeah. I want to use
it. You guys are going to make me ask the question, how bad are the roofs? I mean, how many leaks do we have? I mean, we're
in pretty good shape now, but I would rather be proactive than let the situation deteriorate.
From a replacement standpoint, it depends. And, you know, do we have guarantees still on the membrane?
You
got a 15-year guarantee.
These were 97, 98 roofs,
okay.
Most of them throughout
did
the
district. Did we have 13 or did we have 20?
We had 50, I think we had 15-year roofs.
Okay.
But we've identified, we started in 11, 12, we kind of, 13, now we're getting out to where we really should need to start to address.
That was on that report of the medical stuff we got that one.
That's correct.
17. To me, ultimately a roof can last 10 years or it can last 25, 15 to 20, depending on it's an average, right? So.
Yeah, I tell you what.
I don't necessarily want to replace something that, if the architects go up there and say, hey, this membrane, yeah, it's 15 years old, but it's got a useful life.
5 to 7 years, and that's why we're.
That's what they do with
that's
this.
That's why we're getting the reports. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah, they prioritize every year. I would tell you, I was at a district in the northwest suburbs a few years well before I got here, and I will tell you, it was like 10 years and a day because they valued engineered that roof to fit under their budget number. 10 years and a day, I had to call this guy, and he says, "No,
I don't want to hear that.
Your warranty is over."
Well, the other thing is, again, with the inspections, you're catching things ahead of time, so you're being very proactive with the roof asset.
Well, and the other thing is, we don't
can repair instead of replace.
Right, exactly.
That's where I was just going. We don't ignore our roofs. I mean, typically, I might spend $15,000 to $25,000 a year instead of doing just little patch kind of get by jobs. I'll tell Dave to go out and do a $5,000 section of roof so that we don't have that issue pop up again.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's insurance policies of sort. Understood.
Okay.
I've got to hit that one here.
6:30. Any other questions on the contract then?
Bob, I know I emailed you about this on page 6. You said you were gonna talk to them and kind of lower that dollar amount.
Yeah, because we've identified 700. Oh, you're talking about on the overall construction.
No, 16,000.
16 million. Now that's something that we've already scaled back significantly.
Okay. I saw this number and I'm like,
here's true. I've been working on this contract for a month or 6 weeks, so they came in with a number initially, and we keep peeling it back.
Oh, okay.
That's more appropriate.
And that's fine. I didn't have a basis of where that 16 million came from. So it's going to be scaled back today.
Yep.
Okay.
The next order of business then this evening is the. I had some questions come up last meeting on special education tuition cost analysis. And this is actually getting a little bit ahead of where when I typically do this work. This will occur sometime before the levy hearing in December, but around the last meeting in October, first week of November, you'll get a full booklet of all the large programs within the district and how much it costs for those programs. And what you have here is a spreadsheet that we've used previously that identifies all of our special education programs and all the service costs associated with it, as well as tuition for private facility and other public school tuition or other school tuition, total expenditures, and then any associated revenues with those special education projects, programs, to come up with total revenue and then a net program cost. So we had budgeted in 12-13, we budgeted $7.6 million in special ed expenditures. It came in at just in excess of $7.8 million. Associated revenues, we projected at $2.3 million. They came in at $2.4 million. Not necessarily surprising that you don't get everything that you anticipate. For a net program cost of budgeted of 12-13, almost $5.3 million. And a net program cost of almost $5.6 million is what the actual expenditures or actual program costs came in at. And then I was asked a question by Joe, I believe. You wanted to see, every month you guys see a list of all the accounts payable. And it's a little mind-boggling to see just the sheer volume of expenditures and then also the number of vendors that we use for special ed services. And these, what you're referring to here, really are our schools that we send kids to. It might be a single student. It might be multiple students. I believe, Joe, you came up and you asked specifically about Case.
I looked at the top five because I just want to identify them. And then after I wrote the email, I just started, and I hear you talking here. And thanks a lot for putting this together because it helps me understand where a large part of our budget's going. It's 10% of the budget if you look at the expenses.
Absolutely.
And we're battling this facilities issue. And, I just look at this, and my first question when you were talking is, well, what was it 5 years ago? Where are we trending on this? Are we trending up? Are we trending down? As our population of kids grew, did this grow proportionately or was it disproportionately? Because ultimately, we're sending kids out of our district. Not only do we have them in portables, but we're sending them out of our district. Now, you might have to do that on some of these anyways. I'm guessing the smaller cost, and this is just a guess, and that's why I asked the question. Smaller cost is one or two kids going or five kids going out. So if we had facilities for them, it wouldn't make sense because the personnel for those five kids, unless we build such a big facility and everybody sends it and then we can hire, you know, and then that'd be a revenue. But there's somewhere on the margin where you can start seeing that if we have this many kids and we house them in our new facilities or our expanded facilities, that there could be a savings here. I mean, it rationally just says there should be a savings here. And then there's also the, you know, if you have on the margin, you can bring kids in from other districts, you can actually make it a revenue-generating thing. I can only imagine that these costs have gone up because these people have fixed assets. And the variable asset is mostly the salary.
It's the salary and benefits.
So those are going up. Their fixed costs have stayed the same because they're in 20-year-old buildings. And ComEd and all that's getting priced competitively. So those aren't moving. So it just seems to me, if that's what's occurring, you know, how do we analyze it as a team so that we can say, wow, when FGM is designing this building that, you know, gets approved, if we had these four classrooms dedicated for these special ed areas, we would actually save $3 million out of our budget. I don't know what the number is.
Isn't that what we talked about at our last finance meeting?
Yeah.
We said we need to make sure this is a decision topic when we talk about
facilities. And this has kind of given us now the data.
Yeah.
And that's why I pulled the top five, Patrick, because I'm just trying to think logically here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that's where perhaps we're sending more kids off. Now, that may not be true. There's maybe some services are so expensive because the needs of that child are so great. Maybe it is only four or five kids that cost $180,000.
Well, let me.
I don't know.
I pulled those numbers.
Okay.
And just to give an example, Soaring Eagle Academy, we spent $198,000. That's three students. Giant Steps is $193,000. That was three students. District 15 Marquardt was seven students. And I noticed that with regards to District 89, the annual tuition cost ran somewhere between $29,000 and $32,000. And for Soaring Eagle and Giant Steps, the programs ran between about $20,000 to up to $42,000 or $43,000 per student annually. So it's a pretty significant cost for these particular kids.
It almost seems like this is more something that we go back to Paul and say, Paul, why don't you have your staff put an analysis together and said, were we going to take these programs in-house, where can we get the most bang from the buck? Which ones are the most cost-effective? If it's more an issue of space, as opposed to, is the program so specialized that it's beyond us?
So there's a few. I mean, like autism throughout the country is growing. I mean, it's becoming bigger and bigger in every district, and it's hard because you do have to have there's space. There's certain spaces that the students do better in. So those are an important issue to be thoughtful about. But those numbers in the population are growing. And it's probably probably one of the greatest increases within the special education environment is our autism or structured learning environments. So that's something that we should be looking at. From our case, how many students, what's the largest population of students that we send out to other districts? Because I like your thinking. If we get to a new elementary, how many classrooms would we add on to be able to have our own in-house in-district special education center where if we can take care of many, most, not all, though. I don't know
right.
a district who can support.
Be
because you do have some kids who are significantly impacted and that the cost for them are going to be very, very high, but their specialties
I mean, is that something that we can ask Paul is to have the admin come back with the first? Because we're starting to get down into buildings and what they're going to look like. So we can go down parallel paths and ask the administration to come with a first cut of, yeah, this.
Yep.
If you, and my, maybe it's me thinking wrong, and I don't want a solution here for mm-hmm. you, but it would be like, if 15 students are going to a place, seems to me that would be the logical one, because maybe if we're sending 15 there, the study is more general than we're sending one or two, because that one or two is a very specialized yeah. study program.
Yep.
So it's like, let's look at those groups that have 15, 12 right. kids and say, oh, I think maybe it's a space thing. Or maybe
no, I agree. And I think we can go back to Paul and say, Paul, you know, if we could bring in-house one or two or three of these programs, what would it take from a facility standpoint, from a staff standpoint,
would it offset these costs?
Staff capacity standpoint,
yeah.
You know, and you may say, well, the one that's 15 is just it's beyond us. Mm-hmm. But the one that there are 10 kids, there could be a lot of bang for the buck by bringing that in house.
Yep.
You know, so I mean, I don't feel bad asking you for that. Let me ask you. I mean, if we ask you to go down that path, are we creating undue pressure on you? Are you comfortable taking that on?
Absolutely. You know, one of the implications that I think about right here is, with it just coming to the head, what are the implications to our case, to our
right.
group of districts that we work together? So if we start coming in-house and taking a few things off, are they going to say, hey, you're no longer part of Case now,
right?
And you can't participate with these two others that you can't support? So it's all those different implications. But I think it's wise for us to look at it, to explore it, and to have those conversations internally first,
yeah.
Before we go to Case and Jim Nelson and say, you know, we're looking at taking three or four of these.
He may ask you.
Yeah.
He may say, if you do, then I can do this, and we'll send these kids.
If we're large enough,
right.
that's what they would want to do. As Bob and I were talking earlier, many of the cooperating districts are frustrated with us because we have no space.
There you go.
Most of our students are in other districts.
The market's telling you something. Huh?
They are. They're like, hey, pony up some space over there, your T-41.
The one thing I wanted to add to this, too, you know, it is a numbers, it's a cost game and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not an educator, you guys are, and I rely on this, but I was talking to a parent who has a student that this falls into.
Mm-hmm.
And what she told me was somewhat heartbreaking to hear, because she has younger kids also. And when the younger kids are playing in the park or around the yard, and the older son's there, she said, a lot of times their friends ask, who is that? Because what happens, we have these neighborhood community schools, K through 5. Everybody knows everybody, and when they do the sports teams at the park district, they're by schools, you know? So it becomes a community, and that's what we want, and that's what we promote. So then I hear this story that, you know, I hear this keep everything equity and all this amongst all the schools. Then I hear that story, and I have to tell you, I leave, and it almost brings a tear to my eye, because that's not doing that. And the reason it's not, now some of it's cost prohibitive, but I understand that. But boy, did that hit home. You know, here we're trying to say, hey, from a numbers game, it makes sense to do this if we're going to build a new facility. But boy, from that parent standpoint, from that family standpoint, does it make sense to keep everybody in that community together? And I think that's an important thing to
I think it's a great perspective to bring forward, and, you know, and if you end up building a new elementary where you right-size the schools, mm-hmm. are there more classrooms? Are there more classroom equitably placed throughout this district so you can have our students in our buildings?
Right. I think it's a hard equation.
It is.
But
it gives you at least an opportunity now
right.
to even talk about it as we sit today in our current facilities, we can't even have the conversation.
I thought it was interesting.
It was. It was
interesting.
Great
from, I'm looking at it from a numbers game,
yeah.
and financing, and how much money we're spending. But the emotional behavior standpoint to me was
huge.
Something that was huge. It was bigger than all the numbers I could talk about. You know?
Absolutely.
So it brings perspective.
It does. I appreciate
it. And you know, when you say 10%, it's really the net cost are only 10% of our operating
expenses. Right, right.
It's almost, almost 15 or 16%.
But the net cost and stuff.
No, and then as the enrollment settles down and these sheets are updated, you'll see the... I'll do my best to identify kids with a particular program, so you'll see the number of kids that are enrolled there. It's an inexact science.
Okay.
And remember, we do get federal funding, not nearly enough to cover many of these costs, but there is a lot of federal funding that comes in to support students.
Paul, let me ask you. I think the finance committee and I think for all. We're all kind of thinking we want to go down this path. Is it reasonable to think
we have numbers to you next.
Deliverable for us? Maybe not this meeting, but the following meeting. Is that?
No, that's a great deliverable because we. So what I'm thinking is that we would bring you just hard numbers. Okay. Who's in case? How many students do we have in case? And we can talk from that. We can talk from the hard numbers perspective.
Right.
And what's out there? Where are our kids?
Break it down by these.
The type of program they're in.
These programs.
Yep.
Just like anything else, you know, everything we do is program driven.
Yep.
So, okay, so
we can do that for you.
At least by the second meeting, you'll have a deliverable for our board. I mean, for our
this
finance
group.
Committee. I'm thinking, and again, I'm looking for some consensus from my fellow finance committee members that with this deliverable, we can upstream that to the board in the finance committee report and say we have this report. Maybe we'll talk about it. You know,
I love it.
Board. If you're,
I'm good with it.
You're good with it. Everyone, I'm good with that. Okay.
I'll make a note.
I think there's a lot of potential here.
I think it's some good thinking.
Yeah, I think you're also educating the community on all this,
mm-hmm.
too.
It's a huge amount of money.
It is. It's a big budget item.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Then we will move on to the third item this evening, amendment to the Glenbard Area Property Tax Appeals Consortium Agreement. Back in 2011, Districts 41, 87, and 89 put together a consortium to with the ultimate goal of cutting down our property tax appeals cost with regards to attorney's fees, consultant fees, appraisals, and so forth and so on. We brought that to the board, and it was approved in 2011. Now we have another district that would like to join our consortium, which will reduce our cost, well, I won't say substantially, but to some degree. And District 93, Bloomingdale 93, has now asked to be part of our group. And so you have a board report as well as the original intergovernmental agreement as well as the amendment to that agreement setting forth how this thing will lay out, meaning this updated amendment. I have found it to be of benefit. Typically what happens is, I'll give you an example, apartments along along Roosevelt or along North Avenue. They are District 41 and they're District 87. So we've had a number of property tax appeals over the past couple of years from those two, several of those apartment complexes. So instead of us having to incur all the expenses associated with an appeal and District 87 having their own costs associated with that appeal, we partner together and we pay according to our split then. So we do not share cost with the other elementaries, obviously, but we do share them with the high school district, and the high school shares them with the other elementary school districts. So we have found it to be a real benefit to us. We work together. We probably meet a couple of times a year and review and sort of have an annual report where we put all this together. The attorneys work with us on it, and I have found it to be of value to us. And what you have before you tonight is an amendment to that agreement allowing District 93 to be part of it. Any questions? Drew, you were a member of the board when that came on.
Let me just give a little bit of background because Bob, you know, is very modestly kind of gave you this report. I mean, I think Bob was the driving force in putting this together. It kind of, it, it's if you guys remember the school bus consortium, where we went out as a single group for transportation services, save us a ton of money. Again, Bob was the driving force with this. Similar situation. I don't think when we originally went through this, there was really no downside to this. I mean, really, we're pooling our resources to lower our costs. I mean, that's the bottom line. And again, Bob pretty much worked with these other school district business managers, put this together. But to his credit, this is his brainchild.
Okay. And great idea.
I don't see a downside to this.
And I'll tell you, that transportation agreement saves us about $350,000 to $400,000 annually. Yep. Sorry, I had to throw that in.
But we don't want to talk about that on A4.
No. So, any
sorry,
questions?
I'll throw that one in there. Regarding too.
So with that, Bob, I mean, we've got the other four other guys on the board, but do you want 93 on them?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Well, we all get along, and it's a little bit larger of a school district than what we have, and absolutely. And my bet is we're going to get more people to continue to join us because they see this cost savings that we're all sharing. So, I know, Patrick, we concluded last finance committee meeting with a couple of questions on title funding. And you had some questions on it, and I am not the expert on federal funding. Paul.
So, Julie and I will.
So, Paul's going to step. Paul.
We'll tag team this one a little bit for you. So, we roughly get $180,000 in title funding. Title funding, it will go mainly, a large portion, will go to Churchill Elementary, who is a title elementary school because of their free and reduced population.
Mm-hmm.
We also get Title II, which is professional development monies. And there is a little bit of Title III for ELL. It's not a huge amount of money altogether, but with that money comes a lot of strings from the federal government. And that's where the question started. So how much do we get? What do we get in return for it? And who are we beholden to? And we're beholden to No Child Left Behind. Really holds us accountable for our title schools only. AYP, even though every school has to report out on it and is measured, has measurements on it, the only schools that are held accountable to it are title schools because of the funding they receive.
Now, when you say title school, Paul,
Churchill.
Are you saying Title 1, 2, 3, and 4? Or
Title
just,
1.
Just 180,000.
Yeah. So, Churchill is a title elementary, so they'll receive a large portion of the Title 1 funds from them because of their free and reduced population. And now with their student achievement numbers below the acceptable range, which everyone else, Franklin's above that number, but everyone else is below it. The other schools have no ramifications other than they didn't make AYP, but they still move on with their day-to-day operations. Churchill is in year two,
three
of corrective action.
First year of corrective action, but year three of improvements.
Yeah, so that's...
And then next year, something happens, right? The following year, if I read it right, they have the opportunity to come in and just kind of.
Yeah. So in 2 years,
come into your school.
If things don't change,
right,
it would move into another category called restructuring.
Restructuring, right.
And that's a scary area to be.
Right. And are we for $180,000? Can we buy out?
You've got to buy out, right?
$180,000. Let's see what we can do, and we get off the.
So there's a couple pieces.
String wreck to the wall.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think many staff members agree. There are a couple things in play. One, Illinois put in a waiver for some of these requirements. One of the requirements that Illinois put in for is to hold the bar at 85% of all students will be either meets or exceeds. For Churchill, they're roughly right around 67% at meets and exceeds. So it's at least attainable, more attainable than 100% or 92%, and then 100% the next year. So I want to see where that waiver ends up and if there are any other pieces that are a part of that overall waiver. However, you know, Illinois is one of the few, only eight remaining, who have not been approved. One of the reasons is because of their because of our principal and teacher accountability or evaluation system. It's not as aggressive based off of our timeline. What they're saying is you should have had this thing implemented by this year. It's not, you know, by law, the Illinois law says, really, it's going to be in full effect 15-16. And that's why our waiver, the state waiver, is still being held up. It has not been denied, but it's, as somebody once, something that I read was, it's in purgatory. It's just sitting there, waiting. So I want to see where that waiver ends up, but it still doesn't sound like we would get out of the AYP title, because 85 is still a pretty high bar, and they would, we'd be held accountable to that. So that's one thing I'm looking at. But Patrick, I tend to agree. Does this 180, at the end of the day, does it make fiscal sense when you're in a restructure mode? Because a number of the choices are pretty drastic.
Mm-hmm. Does the statute require you, though, if you've been taking 180?
Right.
Do you have to?
You have.
That?
Oh, and yeah. That's what we're looking into. What other?
180 could be 720 or whatever.
What are the other hooks that that it has into us?
Yeah. What other federal dollars? Because we get other federal dollars.
We do. It is not connected to probably the largest, and that's good. IDEA. It has no connection to our special ed funding. I've spent a lot of time actually with just researching it, working with Julie as we try to figure these pieces out, because there are a lot of tentacles to it, and you don't want to just say no to something, you know.
And then,
but we're spending quality time on this issue.
Yeah, I guess that's my ultimate question, is what's the financial cost of us just saying to divert stage five or whatever it is? I mean, we got one more, and I even think next year something happens where they come in for a review or something, right?
Planning year.
Yeah.
Planning year. So you're starting down the path. So I think after next year, it's going to be a lot harder for us to kind of walk away, mm-hmm. versus right now, we're kind of sitting at the doorstep saying, we might break through that door. If we can just say, no, what, tell us what the financial cost for us to walk away from this deal. And if it's $180,000 and that's it, or they say, well, no, it's $180,000 and they're paying in arrears. And
yeah.
Title two or whatever.
Yep.
Right.
That's a number I'd like
and
to.
The other question that we have to look at, right, is where is this going federally? You know, where is the new child left behind going?
It's federal? Right now it's stagnant. Mm-hmm. Right. There's no energy, there's no conversation on this issue, and that's why they've had to go down this waiver act, and why the Department of Education has chosen to go this route, because they don't feel like, for some reason, Congress is not acting at all on this part of the law, or on this law at all.
Let me ask you about the church. The safe harbors aren't helping us.
No, they're not. They're just not.
We didn't reach that level.
So even
they calculate it for all the souls. Mm-hmm. Harbor, but you have to reach it.
So we didn't, even with the safe harbors, there wasn't enough growth in safe harbors to be able to.
No.
Okay.
Becomes, the further you get into this, the more and more challenging it is to get out of it. I'm just, you know, my background from Adams 12 being a much larger and more diverse district, we had to restructure. We restructured three schools, and they're challenging, from closing a school down and rehiring staff to new programs to new. I mean,
can
it
you
is.
Imagine that conversation happening.
It is a.
Imagine the cost. I bet you it's more than $180,000.
I guarantee you. That's where I've been at on this conversation. It's a lot more than $180,000. So it's just. Do we want to chase the $180,000? And I think it's a great conversation. So we'll just keep reporting back each meeting. I'll keep giving you an update on what we learned, because there's so many little nuances to it and where it comes in and where.
So Bob, this $180,000 and the money and the time and all that, when do you need to know about that? Because we're going to start, like we said, we're starting our budget conversations.
We just put in the title into the federal government. So we're going to be looking at next year. So we're going to have this conversation in the next three to four months. We need to really have a decision.
Right.
One, so we can budget, where are we going to pick up that funding? So, for instance, we pay, probably a lot easier to pass this that way. You wouldn't have to hold it for me, Joe. five reading aids at $125,000. Yeah.
That we are required to provide.
Yep.
And
so, yeah, because without Churchill being a title school, we no longer would have to offer choice, which
right.
It's just an interesting way of going down this. So we'll keep bringing stuff back to this committee on the numbers until you're ready to move it forward to the full board.
Well, that's how that's going to be my next question. Do we want to broach this topic a little bit in full board so it's on record and people can read and understand and see this and say, okay.
How about next time? I'll still bring it back to Finance Committee one more time so we have the numbers and we have a little bit more detail. And then if you guys feel good then we can put it up on the full board agenda. If you're comfortable with that.
Yeah. Well, I recall, and this was a while ago, with Churchill, we allocated for another staff for one of the grade levels. Up here,
Julie.
Because there was an identified gap, and that was supposed to.
I wonder if that came through just general budget.
That was not Title I.
Yeah,
I'm switching gears.
Okay.
This was not.
That's calling out my lifeline. Now. All right, you're off the script.
I would say this a year ago and came to us. Maybe it was more than a year ago. And it came to us and said, you know, we have this gap at Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we close this gap is some additional staff in this specific grade level. And I don't know.
I would have to lean on my buddies in the.
I'm sorry, I'm just.
So last year, out of the general budget, did we allocate some funds to support Churchill with a gap, a need?
Well, the past several years, we have, we've had that part of our process for quest size targets that when the achievement warrants the ability to go below target, and I believe we've done that at Churchill for the last several years.
Yeah.
So you were correct.
Two or three years.
I guess maybe this is not enough. Maybe it's something that we need to talk about.
And the principals and cabinet are meeting with. We're meeting tomorrow to really dig into the data. What's the data telling us? District-wide and then school by school. What's going on here? Because our low-income students, our Hispanic, African-American students are struggling. I mean, when we bring the data to the board, and I believe that's sometime in October, I mean, there's some serious areas that we've got to address. And when you have a higher population of students of poverty or students of color, it's impacting our schools. How are we going to change that? What instructional approaches do we need to do to change that? And do they need additional staff? Sometimes you do. So it's a big issue. Yeah, that's an issue across the country.
If we chose not to accept the title money, we still want to make sure we're doing things, and we have to communicate that, even though we're not being held to that standard, if we get to that
point. Joe, that's a great point.
But this is what we're doing.
We'll hold
we'll hold ourselves to a higher standard.
Right. That's a great point.
But we just
because you don't want it to come across as, all right, all's well now.
Yeah,
all's well.
Ready to go away.
Look the other way.
It sounds like we're putting restructuring beyond the standards that they wanted anyway. So we're doing it anyways.
Yeah.
So we will continue to do so, but then the restructuring...
I just don't want the heavy on
this. I think great.
Julie, did you want to add something there?
Well, there are a lot of restrictions on how we can spend the money. We would not spend the money the way necessarily the way we spend it to comply with all of the regulations with Title I. So that's a little bit of a...
The great piece is Julie's the administrator of the title fund. She knows it better than anybody.
Because
it's money.
If you're getting $180,000, you're spending $9 of it inefficiently. Then all we have is $90 spending efficiently.
Oh no!
All right. We did.
I think we're good.
That's it for this evening's meeting.